Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 53 of Histories of the Unexpected, where we will be audio googling through history, exploring the history of things you didn't even know had a significant story to tell, like the history of hearts, frogs, or majesty.
Or peas, fleas, and decrees. The hen, Big Ben, and the pen. Everything comes back to stationery.
And rhyming for you.
And rhyming for me. I'm stuck in a rut of rhyming at the moment. And we'll be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how simply everything, Sam, has a history. And crucially, how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, that the history of lions is all about Gustavus Adolphus, that Swedish king, the Lion of the North, or about ice cream and, of course, freedom, or that the history of hats was all about witchcraft, kingship, and politeness. Oh, and bishops' mitres, which, of course, brings us round to the history of the Reformation.
The man sitting opposite me is the Wizard of Weeks. It's Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daywell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. Very good to see you. And the man sitting opposite me is the truly wonderful, the majesty of microbes. It is the wonderful Dr. Sam Willis.
This week,
what are we doing?
Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that there's quite a lot of noise because we're in the shed down the end of my garden and I live next to a railway line. So if you hear some kind of squeaking, groaning and moaning, it's not us, it's trains.
Yes, and in case you didn't get it, we are unexpectedly dog-sitting today. So if you hear dogs barking in the background, that's what it is. And of course, we should do the unexpected history of dogs, having done cats.
And breaking and entering.
And breaking and entering crime.
Mm.
Fences.
That would be good. I'd be really interested in that, actually, yeah.
Yes.
Theft. That's all to do with absence, isn't it? Anyway, we're here because we are going back onto a subject we've done previously to do a bit of an update on it.
But because inspired by several things.
Correct.
In the news, namely Big Ben.
Yeah. We're going back to our episode on the history of clocks, which we did live at Plymouth University. Yes. It was one of my most enjoyable ones, and the history of clocks is absolutely fantastic. So the fact that Big Ben has stopped in the news at the moment has really got us excited again about the history of clocks.
Yes, and people are getting really upset about the fact that this clock, or the bell, Big Ben, the bell to be specific, is basically not going to be working for the next 4 years, except for certain dates, like Remembrance Sunday, for example.
Why do you think people have gotten such a fuss about it?
Why is that?
Yeah.
It's all over the place. The Prime Minister has been out saying, oh, we're going to, you know, rethink the whole thing. Why do you think it is?
I think it's all to do with the importance of Victorian clock towers.
Well, I think it's also the sound of it. It's such a nostalgic... If you think about it, it's such a nostalgic sound. Can you remember a time when you did not remember hearing that clock? That clock is something of my childhood.
Yes, no, I think so, because, well, its bongs are broadcast by the BBC. There's a microphone in there, isn't it? So it's the sound of Britain, which is...
Yes.
Well, I think certainly it was broadcast through Empire quite consciously. They wanted to broadcast the sound of the clock.
Mm.
So what you've got, I think, is... Well, if you think about Victorian clock towers, so you know, from the 1850s and 1860s, it's all to do with railways, isn't it? People start building clock towers and time becomes massively important throughout the UK.
Yeah.
An important part of that was clock towers, so people could look up to a tower and they could see what the time was.
Yeah.
And so you'd end up with these kind of almost like village clock towers or town clock towers. And Big Ben is kind of like that, but for the British Empire. It's the village clock tower of Britain throughout the world.
Yeah, and throughout the country as well. And I think it has a really important cultural resonance today because of the role that it's played in the past.
And what I also like about it is this interest in the name of it. So Big Ben, as you say, relates to the bell.
Yeah.
But people are worried about... They're not worried about the clock stopping. They're worried about the bells not ringing.
Yes.
That's what is bothering people more than the absence of time.
Because that's what denotes the time.
I haven't often considered this kind of very explicit link between time and sound before.
Yeah. A grandfather clock, for example.
It's a sort of summons. You know, it's time to go to work, basically. Yeah. We talked about this with clocks before, isn't it? Clocks and time ordering the lives.
Keeping you to account, ordering your everyday lives. You said it's about empire. It's also about security. It's a sound of the nation. And it's a sound that kept going throughout the world wars. You know, there are certain times when it has stopped throughout its history. I think during the Blitz, it were some of the hands were damaged and it couldn't work for a while. But throughout the Blitz, it becomes this security sound that basically shows that the country is still going. Mm. And it's sent out to the troops so that they know that the, you know, the mothership or whatever is still intact. And I think it's that symbolism that people associate it with. It's a sense of Britishness.
The opposite of silence is emergency as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Certainly
yeah.
with bells, you know, ringing out emergency. But also coming back to this summons for church, whether it's mass yeah. Or whatever yeah. it is.
But do you know the times that it has stopped recently?
No.
Margaret Thatcher's funeral, where they switched off the bells as a sign of respect. The same with Winston Churchill's funeral.
See, I was thinking of stopping the clocks, which is to do with funerals.
The Auden poem. Yeah.
Yes, we'll stop all the clocks, cut off the telephone, prevent the dog from barking with a juicy bone, silence the pianos with muffled drum. Sorry, and with muffled drum, bring out the coffin, let the mourners come. Which is the, you know, the funeral blues from, we all know it from Four Weddings and a Funeral, don't we?
Yeah.
So stopping clocks as part of funerals, for me, is a more obvious link than sound. So I'm quite surprised by that.
Mm.
It's quite a significant thing then, isn't it?
It is quite a significant thing. And it means that, you know, the passing of, the halting of time.
Yeah. So one of the things that bothered me about it is a load of politicians saying there's a huge amount of guff has been spoken about Big Ben stopping. But yeah. I think what we're trying to make everyone realise is actually in that silence is a really interesting history.
Yes.
And the history of clocks and our reaction to what's going on is massively important.
Yeah. And it's also entirely practical, the reason that it's stopping. It's going to take 4 years to, you know, restore the clock. It's going to take about 2 years, apparently, to take it apart and then put it back together again. And it takes half a day in order to then set it up so that it will ring. And also the bell, you think about those poor people who are going to be working in the tower.
Yeah.
The bell is 118 decibels when it rings, which is louder than an aeroplane setting off. And this could cause people serious damage.
Yeah. So I mean, it all comes back to the health and safety.
Yes, you know, it's health and safety.
It is very sensible.
I mean, one of the things that we're doing at the moment is we are, in some ways, we're talking about our travels where we've been off over the summer
yep.
and things that have inspired us and in unexpected ways. And wandering around the Natural History Museum in London and going through their amazing exhibit
yep.
on volcanoes and earthquakes, which if you haven't been to, is incredible, absolutely incredible. You can go into a room that simulates an earthquake. You have a bar
wow.
to hang on to. But it's basically a recreated, I think, Japanese supermarket. And you can sort of, and I'm shaking here as I'm doing this.
You can see you
should take this. I went on this and experienced it. And it really gives you that kind of sensation of being in an earthquake. But what I'm going to talk about is about this clock here.
Oh.
Do you want to describe that? Because in our last episode on clocks, Sam had discovered all these amazing clocks that,
yeah, so
that had
became
stopped.
Obsessed with clocks that were frozen in time.
So I texted him this.
Well, so wait, one from the Titanic.
Yes.
I did one from
Hiroshima
and another
Ground Zero.
One, Ground Zero.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I used those frozen clocks to talk about people deliberately stopping yeah. time, like Miss Havisham
yes.
in Dickens.
Yes.
And so I'm quite excited about this. This is a pocket watch. It's got Roman numerals around it. It looks kind of early 20th century, and its hands are missing. It's been smashed and possibly scorched. I don't know, but certainly the face is broken, but there's enough of it left to see that it very much is a pocket watch.
Yeah, it's a destroyed watch. I sent Sam a little text of this and then dug around to find out what it's from. And it is from 1902, 8th of May, when we had one of the worst, probably it's been labelled the worst volcanic explosion of the 20th century. And it happened in Mount Pelee in Martinique. Martinique is a Caribbean island, a sort of French colony. And on this day, it exploded in absolutely incredible, incredible style. It's known as a pyroclastic.
Okay, a pyroclastic
eruption, which is basically...
Isn't that what happened at Pompeii?
Is it?
I think so, yeah.
But it's gas and lava. It's more or less sort of liquid flame that comes down, and it can travel at incredible speeds.
Yeah.
This volcano travelled at 440 miles an hour. It reached the nearby town of Saint-Pierre within a minute. And the way that it worked, the flow just hugged the ground level and then just ignited everything that it touched immediately. They knew that things were going wrong for, you know, for a month or so beforehand. There's this dry lake at the top of the mountain, which had basically filled with water and was about 180 metres across, and it started bubbling. The telegraph official who was keeping track of this was sending these regular reports backwards and forwards and said, oh, nothing happened. His last report was, allez! Was literally, get the hell out of there.
I've just Googled this, okay, and I didn't know about it. And the images are like Hiroshima. All that's left are just sort of ankle-high remains and some kind of, all that, like the worst of the Blitz. Roofs gone, walls gone, utter devastation. This watch is linked to that.
It's one of the surviving elements of it.
Was it an important part of the exhibition?
It was a very important part of the exhibition.
Was it kind of central?
There are a few sort of artifacts that survived.
Yeah.
And this was one of the main things. And it's quite iconic, this sort of stopped clock.
Yeah.
And there were almost no survivors. The town of about between 28 and 30,000 people, because people from the villages further up nearer the mountain had come into the town, so the population swelled. Almost everyone was dead instantly. Two people survived. There was a prisoner who was in this sort of dungeon cell with no windows, and he managed to survive. And then there's another man, Camper Leandre, who lived on the edge of the city, and we have his testimony of exactly what happened.
Oh, great.
I want to read it to you here. I felt a terrible wind blowing. The earth began to tremble and the sky suddenly became dark. I turned to go into the house with great difficulty, climbed the three or four steps that separated me from my room, and felt my arms and legs burning, also my body. I dropped upon a table. At this moment, four others sought refuge in my room, crying and writhing with pain, although their garments showed no sign of having been touched by flame. At the end of 10 minutes, one of these, the young De La Vorde girl, aged about 10 years, fell dead. The others left. I got up and went to another room where I found the father, still clothed and lying on the bed, dead. He was purple and inflated, but the clothing was intact. Crazed and almost overcome, I threw myself on a bed, inert and awaiting death. My senses returned to me in perhaps an hour when I beheld the roof burning. With sufficient strength left, my legs bleeding and covered with burns, I ran to Font Saint-Denis, 6 kilometres from Saint-Pierre.
Cool.
So this is an incredible story of survival as well. You know, the fact that these sort of horrific goings on are happening around you, the fact that you are in such personal bodily pain, but you are able to muster all your resources to drag yourself out of there. But again, time, clock.
It's wonderful. And I was just saying here that the eruption was at 7:52, which is when this guy did his last transmission of Ali. So 7:52 in the morning.
Yep.
But it was a bit more strangled. Hello! 7:52. So that clock, you know, we don't know where it came from, but I'm assuming it was 7:53, 7:54.
You can almost see on it, it depends which way round you hold it, doesn't it? But you can almost see one of the hands still intact.
Yeah, and it looks like it's been melted on.
It looks like it's been melted on, and here it's been melted on there. So what are we looking at there? If we say that is 12... Goodness me, no, I can't read this clock at all. No,
but the point is, we can...
Not even going to attempt to.
We can add 7:53 on... what's the date of it? 8th of May 1902 to our list of stop clocks, which we discovered.
I think we should write about it. I think it's a brilliant example.
Okay. Well, we can add it to 3:07 a.m. on the 15th of April 1912, which is Titanic.
Yes.
We can add it to 8:15 a.m. on the 6th of August 1945, which was Hiroshima. And we can add it to 10:04 on the 11th of September 2001.
Yes.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
One of the things that I'm interested in also, to take it in a different direction, is why are historians so interested in time, you know, and thinking about change over time? I mean, after all, that's what historians are concerned about doing. How have we evolved to where we've come to today? And this is something that always struck me. As a young boy, I used to spend hours chatting to my great-grandmother. And my great-grandmother lived to be 98. Mm-hmm. And she was born in Victorian England.
Yeah.
She was born in the small seaside town of Beer in Devon, mm-hmm. which is beautiful, if any of you have never been there. Beautiful little town. And I just think growing up in rural Devon, quite what that woman must have seen living to 98. She died in the early 90s now, I think.
Yeah.
And incredible. I mean, you just think of what has happened. She has witnessed most of the events from the turn of the century, you know, most of the 20th century. She's witnessed world wars.
Two
world wars. She's lost children, you know, lost a husband. She has seen so much technological advancement in terms of transatlantic flight, in terms of motor cars and all that. How has her life changed in that way?
Mm. Well, what I think is interesting about that is, from our perspective, about her experience being unique, but of course it wasn't unique.
No.
And, you know, that's the real difference.
Yeah.
And how something so prevalent, which was experienced and understood and witnessed by millions of people,
yeah.
becomes gone. How something can be so common and then just vanished. I like that. I also think the other thing about historians and time is there is an academic study of chronology, which I've only recently yes. come across. I didn't know anything about this,
right.
but of course there must be. Chinese history is a great one. Written records only go back a certain distance, and the very, very old records are very vague about right. times and periods. So the length of reigns, the names of people, we take so much of it for granted. You know, we know about Henry V, we know about Edward III, we know what happened in our history because of written records. But someone has kind of gone through it all and worked out chronology. And these chronologists and the chronologies, it's still ongoing work. And people are using more and more exciting, more scientific techniques to date the past, basically.
And the thing with chronology is, how do you start thinking about chronology? You know, how do you impose a chronology, you know, that makes any sense? If you're doing political history, it's quite easy to impose a sort of political chronology that looks at the changing reigns, for example, or changing prime ministers. But if what you're doing is you're looking at something like the history of the clock or the kinds of things that we do, they don't necessarily fit naturally into that kind of chronology.
Interesting.
Or if you deal with social and cultural history,
yeah.
it doesn't fall into that. If you think about a periodization as well, the way in which people periodize the past from the ancient world to
the Middle Ages.
The Middle Ages, yeah. What on earth does that mean?
Yeah, in between
really?
What?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So in between the Dark Ages and the Enlightenment.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And Dark Ages is a term that we, you know, we're not allowed to use anymore because it's a very sort of negative term for a period that was in fact much more, much richer and more vibrant than we think of. But what you've got is these series of ages or epochs.
So who came up with these titles? This is amazing. I know
these emerge from the
Who said, oh, the Dark Ages, post-Roman, let's call it dark, and then I don't know what to call this.
Historians of the past.
Let's call it middle.
Yes. Did I tell you about the astronomical clock that I found in Lund?
Gosh, you're back to clocks.
Cathedral.
Okay. Yep.
This summer.
No, tell me about that.
Oh, absolutely extraordinary clock. It shows it plays in Dulce Jubilo. Can you Google it there? Because I haven't. I'm not online.
Okay.
In your
in my shed, in my magic shed.
In your there we are. That's it.
Ah, that looks very similar to the one in Exeter.
Yes,
doesn't it? I'm struggling here. What is an astronomical clock?
An astronomical clock is not an ordinary clock, but it's a clock that not only tells the time, but also tells other things to do with where the sun, the moon set. It allows you to sort of check the planets and their sort of orientation. Importantly, for this period, it also allows you to date feast days. So as Easter and dates like that and saints' days move and shift, it allows you to date that. But this was produced, they think, in about 1380.
Yeah.
And the 1300s are the time when you get these astronomical clocks being produced throughout the Western and the Eastern
outside
world.
Outside or inside?
It's inside.
Like the Exeter one?
It's inside, like the Exeter one.
I wonder why it's inside. Surely outside's better. I mean, all the clocks outside. I found out that the Eiffel Tower used to have a clock.
There are lots of clocks outside.
Yeah.
Astronomical clocks outside. But Yeah.
Isn't there one in St. Mark's Square? I think there might be.
I think there is. I think there's also one in Munich.
Okay.
There are lots in France, in Beauvais, in Besançon. There are clocks in Rouen, lots in France.
Okay.
All sorts of clocks like these.
The different types of clocks.
Yes.
I like that. And what I like about it is this kind of powerful reminder that time is, of course, all linked with the heavens. It has to be,
yes,
by definition, and also with navigation around our own planets. The most important bit about that, I think, is to understand the difference between the way people told the time before the 1850s, which is when Big Ben was built, wasn't it? Or 1830, 1840s. Yep. But it's around that kind of period. So, and
back
that's all
Ben.
To do with railways as well. It's all to do with
timetables.
So basically, time, wherever you were in the UK, noon, 12 o'clock, was when the sun was directly ahead, when the shadows were shortest. So you could put a shadow stick in the ground and it would have a long shadow, long shadow, long shadow, short shadow, and it would get long again. And that moment is when the sun was directly ahead, and that was noon. Okay. The problem is it's different everywhere, all over the country. And that matters hugely for railway timetables.
Yes. Greenwich Mean Time.
Yeah. So, and then it changed around the 18th. I'm being a bit vague here, but I know it's kind of mid-19th century, when it suddenly became massively important to say, actually, no, this is noon right now for the whole country. And it's not different in Cornwall as it is in Norfolk.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the difference between east and west matters more than north and south because of the way the sun moves. You can think about Greenwich Mean Time and then how they signalled noon by dropping that ball. They've got a kind of ball on a stick above the Royal Observatory at Greenwich. Mm. But that wasn't the only ball on a stick. It is now, but there were balls on sticks all over the country. And when the ball rose and rose and rose and rose and rose, and then it went boom, and that's when it dropped, and that was noon. And so balls on sticks was actually a very well-known way of telling the time.
And what's interesting also is why it's so important to have standard time like that.
Yeah. But also coming back to it, so every day at noon, because clocks weren't as accurate as they are now.
Yeah.
And going back to Big Ben, again, Big Ben has these, they're gone now, but they had a collection of tiny 1p pieces on the pendulum to stop it going too fast, basically. Yeah.
And they took them off when it was going 7 seconds too fast, apparently.
So you had to always go back to a specific time and to reset your watch.
Yeah. But this idea of why you want to standardise time is all about imposing order.
Yeah.
So, you know, as a state, as a power, as a government, as a system, you want to impose your standard time across a country, which then, of course, is important in terms of trade, in terms of business, in terms of joining things up. It's the same reason that people try and impose ideologies or the same coinage, the same language. You know, time again is a sort of mechanism of power connected to empire, imperialism. Of course, timetables are very dangerous. Railway timetables are very dangerous.
Are they?
Caused the First World War. according to A.J.P. Taylor. Oh. War by Timetable. Brilliant little book, entirely polemic. But it argues, I'm sure I've talked about this when we talked about clocks before, but it argues that the whole reason that war came out was because the Russians mobilized before the Germans, because it was all down to the way in which their trains ran.
Yep.
So go out and read War by Timetable by A.J.P. Taylor.
And I think just to move on to where we're going to go next and in the future, I'd like to do a history of height.
Height.
Because I think Big Ben it leads into so many really wonderful questions about being seen. Now, I saw this photograph of loads of politicians kind of leaning up and looking at it. It's about being seen.
Yep.
It's about privileged view. It's also about this soundscape. We were talking about bells. So if sound is higher up, it goes further.
Yeah. It's about towers.
It is about towers, which I
used to live when I was growing up as a kid. I used to live by the sea in Hornsey, and I lived in a house called Tower House.
Right.
And the reason we called it that was because it had an enormous folly in the back garden, 100 metre folly. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, in Victorian times, when the person who owned the house was travelling, was a merchant who was travelling from Hull, and he wanted his meal to be ready for him when he was coming home, and he got his servant to go up and stand in that tower to watch his coach coming back along the road. Tower House. I've probably got the history of that all sort of jumbled up. That was the story that I knew.
And there are two
as
good,
a seven-year-old.
There's Telegraph Hill near Exeter.
Yes.
So hills become massively important with the telegraph, with telegraph system. So they're actually systems of communicating. And Armada beacons.
Mm.
And there's also a
which,
Roman...
Which, were never lit.
They were never lit.
Supposedly.
There's a Roman signalling station on a hill just over there, about a mile away.
Tower of Babel.
Tower of Babel. Very good. Well, let's do the history of height. I'm fascinated. And also, because we're writing our book, what book are we writing, James?
What book are we writing? Histories of the Unexpected.
Ah.
It will be in your Christmas stockings at Christmas 2018.
We're going to do a mini series on
buy it for everyone.
A mini series on the history of writing, aren't we? So
yes,
we're going to break it down into what are we doing? We're doing
well. We've done the study, and we've done the pen, and we've done the letter. So I think we're going to do handwriting.
History of handwriting.
History of handwriting.
I don't believe handwriting has a history. You'll prove me wrong.
Handwriting has a really important history.
Paper.
Paper.
Yeah. I don't believe paper has a history.
Paper. I have agreed to give a talk in January arguing that paper is the most important invention of all time.
Apart from clocks.
No. Paper is. I have no idea why, but I've said I will do it, and do it I will.
Fine. All right.
So we've got to do paper.
We're doing paper. We're doing codes.
We're doing codes. Ooh,
different types
codes.
Of writing.
Code is about writing, but it's also about tattoos.
Oh, okay.
And straps.
And straps.
Straps.
What
yeah,
does that
I'll
mean?
Leather straps.
Okay.
Oh, the history of books.
In themselves, which is, there is an obvious and well-known history of books, but we'll be doing an unexpected history of books, won't
it's
we?
All about magic. It's all about fire, magic, and it's about things that you find in books. There's a brilliant book, I'll just give you a little taster, brilliant book in the Folder Shakespeare Library. This is a 17th century book, and in it is a pair of rather rusty spectacles.
Mm.
So it's not about reading. Books aren't about reading. Nobody reads books. Books are weapons. Books are talismans. Books are totems.
That's just very good. And this links with the one we've just done on the signature. When I talked about my signature, the signature part two, that was, wasn't it?
Yes.
And I suddenly said, I bet you somewhere there is an early version of my signature. And weirdly, I found it. I went to stay with my mum and dad the other night. Hello, mum and dad.
Hello, Sam's mum and dad.
And they gave me a collection of my old school books. So here we have, this must be from 88, 89, maybe?
It's a very clean school book. My school books are covered in scrawls.
There we are. 8 out of 10. I was obviously very, very bright. Oh, no, 48%. That was terrible. What was that? Passage A.
Is there a signature on it?
That's the point, isn't there? It is written at the beginning with Sam Willis, name Sam Willis. And tell me what you make of that. I'm rather surprised by it. It's completely unlike my writing now.
Well,
it's quite well formed writing. It's so I
it's
reckon I was probably 13
writing.
Or 14.
And it's written with my expertise here. It looks like it's written with an ink pen.
Yes.
So rather than a biro, written with an ink pen. So I'm assuming a fountain pen. And it says Sam Willis. I'm not somebody who's an expert in graphology.
I think one of the points is my handwriting is very spiky. Okay, it is now. No, it is italic and spiky.
You're not spiky. You're
very rounded and
you're
kind.
You're fluffy.
Generous. That's not true, by the way. But the origins of my spiky signature are very clear, and I would actually suggest that my S looks a bit like a lightning bolt.
I think you are, in fact, Harry Potter. But look, this is interesting at the back. See, the interesting thing with school books is not about the lessons. It's not about the syllabus. It's not about the marks or anything. It's about the graffiti.
Yeah.
And at the back here, there's somebody who's been scrawling in your book.
No.
Who's that? That's a sort of practice signature. Isn't it Kelly or somebody? Who's
no,
Kelly?
Well, I don't know. It's not me, is it?
No. Somebody got hold of your book and scrawled in it.
Well, hang on. That's pretty cool writing. Look at that.
Ooh, five things.
The bit at the top. The title.
Prep story.
So I had to write something called prep story, and I've written it in a sort of chunky, square, weird writing.
See, the history of handwriting is fascinating. We're recording that tomorrow, aren't we?
I was I was experimenting with my handwriting from an early age. It never sort of settled.
Good.
And one more thing I have. I've got a whole book full of school books here. I've also got this. This is cool.
So I bet this is something you won. Are you showing off now, Willis?
It is a
This is what I won for being the best at everything.
Shut up.
Oh, look at that.
There we go. It is a silver sort of tray plate made out of solid silver, presented to Mate William John Adlam Willis, Royal Navy, who is my great-grandfather, by Admiral, Captain and Officers of HMS Delhi in 1920, and they've all signed it. So here...
Oh, so the signature is about trophies. It's about memory. It's about celebration of somebody, the signing somebody's...
I don't understand what's happened there. So they've signed it, and an engraver has copied their signature.
Yes. Gosh, that's incredible. So is this on the occasion of his retirement?
Yeah.
Or
it's a lovely thing, isn't it?
What a lovely thing.
It's
much better than a card that you then lose. HMS Delhi, 1920.
There's a Paget there, P-A-G-E-T. Is it Paget or Paget? I never
Paget.
Know. Paget. Very famous.
Famous political family, the
famous
Pagets.
Admiral, actually. Ooh, famous naval family, I would say. And some various other people here. So it's a really smashing thing, this. I'm going to have it on my wall.
Excellent.
I was trying to see whose signature I like out of all of these the most. Walter Cowan. He's got a lovely, lovely long C.
You should put a photograph of that up on Twitter for people.
Yes, I will. I will do that now. Who's got the worst? Well, that's a beautiful one. J.M. Clark, I reckon.
And our new look website.
Poor old M.S. Bradley. Bradley, terrible signature. Can barely write. Anyway, thank you for listening to us. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and please tell all your friends. But do please leave a review. It really helps us spread the word. We're on Twitter. You can follow me at Dr. Sam Willis.
And you can follow me at James Daybell. And you can follow us at Unexpected Pod. We are proud to be part of the excellent History Hit Network, home of Dan Snow's History Hit, and a series of other fantastic shows that you should check out.
And you can find out more about what we've got planned in the forthcoming months. Show notes, video clips, photos of everything we discuss, and much more at historyhit.com/unexpected. Bye!
Bye!
If you enjoy this podcast and you like learning about the past, check out my latest venture. It's called History Masterclass, and it's a new type of historical event where you can actually learn in person from the best historians around today in unique and stunning historical locations. You can find out more at thehistorymasterclass.com and follow on Facebook and Twitter at TheHistoryMC.